closer.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Hey, this is exciting, guys. We're back. You know, the world has gotten better. Everything's fine.
It's perfect now.
We're back to traveling and doing shows. I mean, real quick, just so nobody thinks that I fired Simon.
Or Simon quit.
Yeah. He did not quit. He is working on this amazing puzzle company that has been incredibly successful, and he just does not have the time to do podcasting, as they say, podcasts right now.
But this podcast needs to be done.
It does. You know, the last one I did was July with David Kovac, and it was such a good episode. I'm like, that's a good one to take a break on because, you know, he had a lot of knowledge, a lot of good things. And frankly, I needed a break from doing the podcast. It's a lot to hear my voice constantly. And then, you know, it's just kind of been creeping in, and I've been feeling like I want to do it again, bring it back. The fans have spoken. One guy has spoken.
That one guy.
How much they miss the show. And yeah, I think it, this is like talk therapy for me. So this is important. And I wasn't sure. I don't like really doing it on my own. I've done a bunch of interviews by myself, and it's just not as fun. I always like to have a co-host slash other host. And Robert Ramirez is a friend of mine. We've been performing together, you know, kind of on and off for a year, and we have a weird, similar sense of humor. He makes fun of me a lot, and I figure that's good.
Yeah, that's a good start for a friendship. Like,
yeah.
That's definitely my, if like someone makes fun of me, they're definitely like on the radar of like, this person might be a good friend.
Yeah, because they're not worried about your feelings. I think there's a mutual respect there. But anyway, really quickly, just getting that out of the way. Robert's going to be here for, you know, a few episodes, maybe longer, maybe indefinite, just whenever Simon decides to be able to come back to the real world.
Whenever he stopped being successful,
as
they say.
Which you don't know in a magic puzzle company. That could go on for generations.
Yeah, his kids' kids will still be not able to do anything.
Simon Cornell having children is the most... I there's a line I use in my show that I have directly ripped off him. He's like, "You, tiny human, help me out." Because it's literally the way he's like me. He doesn't really know how to relate to children, even though, you know, I worked at Disney World for many years. But just like, that's kind of Simon in a nutshell. Tiny human, please help me. I do not know how to relate to your ways.
I kind of don't know how to either. If there's like a kid in my show, I can't even think of like the age that's like perfect. It's like 7-year-olds. It's like kids who like want to be on stage but also hate being on stage. So they're kind of like, they're really sassy at that age because they're just like, "Oh, I want to be here, but like also you're not going to be in control of this." Like that's the only age I like.
If you want a great drunk test for if something's going to hold up at like the 11:30 show at the Magic Castle or a comedy club, do it for a bunch of 13-year-olds or 7 to 13-year-olds, they will tell you to your face that you're terrible.
Correct.
And that this routine is god awful.
Yeah, and I liked it. I like to, like, that age, I try to talk to them like they were drunk adults, was like almost overcomplicating it for them or like over helping them, but still like talking to them like people. I think that's the biggest problem, not even just performing. Like, people talk to children like they're pet animals.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think you really have to talk to them like people, and they understand that mutual respect.
Yeah. And I mean, this is definitely from like performer to audience member. I don't have children. You don't have children. I mean, your sister seems to have lots of children.
At the same time.
At the same time. So you're around kids more than I am because you see your family quite a bit. But I totally understand that because there is something to like, you talk to them like they're humans, and then when they are being a dick to you, you can immediately, you now have the power to call it out, and all the adults laugh. It's like, why would you say that? You know, you call out the thing. And we did a socially distant show in September in Colorado, you and I, and I feel like there was a moment in that show where you just called something out. We had a couple kids that, it was a lot of families, but they came back to the show. And
yeah.
There was a few kids where I think just by the third show we did,
it was someone
very
calling
tiny audiences.
Yeah,
don't get mad at us. Very tiny audiences.
It was someone calling out like a color, like what's your favorite color or something.
Yeah, oh, that was it. Yeah, Yeah. And she... It, no, that was it. Yeah, do you remember it?
I don't... It was something about green, and this girl was just kind of like, meh. Like, she
Oh, yeah. I was mixing up the Rubik's Cube. This is how I do it now. I mix it from a distance, and I go, okay, I think we got all sides. And she, it's just this 7-year-old girl screams out, you missed green! And I go, oh, thank you so much. Is green your favorite color? No!
Like, she could have had a she could have had a glass of bourbon and a cigarette in one hand and just been like, no,
go back to your magic tricks.
Keep spinning that Rubik's Cube.
What are you gonna do with it? Something magical, I hope.
Get him out of here.
And even when like the trick ends, still wasn't very impressed.
No, it was just like, yeah, but you still forgot that green side.
Yeah. Well, you didn't mix them all up, so who gives a crap?
Yeah.
You're not magic. You think you are, but you're not.
Ah.
But I think that, I mean, I see so many kids performers who are really good at that. Like Chris Capehart, I worked with him before. Actually, the same gig years ago. And he was just great at just calling out children of just, okay, what are you talking about, kid? Shut up. And now the adults love it.
Yeah.
So good.
It's that, yeah, you just got to, like, talk to them like people. And I think, like, they feel better about it, too. Because then if you bring them up and you're just like, oh, will you, can you hold this? Okay, let me, then I think they feel like, ugh, I feel like I'm being treated like a child.
Sure, yeah. There's definitely something, too, I'm sure teachers can speak to this, something of just, like, you know, if you're talking to them, talking down to them, it's establishing authority. But I think when you're up there doing magic tricks for kids, I don't know what your authority is. You're just a guy like them, also like living in a world of make-believe.
Correct. I would say that's accurate.
How have been things for you? I have a socially distant show today. It's my first one since the one we did in September. It's for like small group, 20 people. I'll be far away. Don't send angry letters. And they literally had to buy out the entire restaurant for 20 people. It'll be outdoors. And I'm incredibly nervous. I get nervous before shows all the time, but I am incredibly nervous because I haven't done a show since the one we did with you.
Correct. And I also think there's a, I get afraid when I'm in a new situation. Like if, like the castle never scares me in any of the rooms because it feels like what's the same thing, right? The manager's going to introduce me. I'm going to come out. I'll do it. There'll be people there. I'll finish. I'll walk backstage. It'll be fine. And I do it over and over and over again. And then like even private parties was kind of like that where or walk around gigs was like the first few times was nerve wracking. And then it was like, oh, okay, yeah, I just go up. I find the person, my contact person. And then you just kind of do the thing. So you're about to be in another situation where it's like super brand new that no one can give you advice on like what to expect from someone buying out a restaurant for 20 people.
It's all the unknowns. It's like, okay, what does the space look like? Where do I park? Is it going to be, I know I don't have power. So I like invested in this like lithium battery that's for like charge an extra 3-hour charge for your computer. And just all these things I prepped. Oh, and then yesterday, I think it was yesterday too, I just went to pull out my speaker. I haven't used it in months and the speaker is broken, doesn't work. Oh. So I had to quickly reorder a brand new Bose speaker. So now I'm making negative money for this show that could be potentially dangerous. But I said yes to because I'm so desperate to perform in front of real people.
Yeah, I'm like right on the verge of that where I'm trying to make up lectures just so I can be like, someone take this lecture for me so I can do it.
Sure.
So that, yeah, because even like any gigs I have just kind of all been word of mouth and stuff or like people have hired me before. And even like the Zoom shows, I get kind of nervous because I keep thinking I can do a better show than I did. And I'm just thinking like, oh, I'm sure there's better material. I should be doing something else that's better. And then like last minute, I don't change it. And then I think, oh, I hope this works.
Yeah, it's tough because, I mean, I've always been kind of lazy where it's like if something works, it stays in the set forever. But I'm also still good about sandwiching in new material and, you know, a normal world. But yeah, the Zoom stuff, like I've recently invested in some more in the studio. I was showing you the studio to make it look nicer, nice camera switcher, nicer camera, better computer. And I'm still like more concerned about making sure the tech works as opposed to maybe I should try out this new card trick. Because I'm like, no, at this point, I want to just have complete muscle memory. So when my computer explodes,
correct,
I can handle that.
Yes, 100%. And I feel like because I'm not doing a lot of Zoom shows or a lot of anything online, is that like I'm trying to get the bare minimum so that I can still, it's like that, because I already, my internet crashed the last show I did, and it was right before the last trick, and luckily they let me back on. They like finished their costume contest, and then I finished the last
trick. This was like a big client, too. You were telling me this was for what, Bento Box?
For Bento Box Productions, which does Bob's Burgers and some other great shows, a lot of Comedy Central shows. And it was just the last trick we designed, Gwen and I designed for Bob's Burger. It had Bob's Burger characters that were made specifically for the trick. Gwen, like, hand drew Bob dressed as Doug Henning, which doesn't exist. And so, like, the second the internet crashed, I was more disappointed that the idea of, like, all that work we did for them specifically was about to get wasted if I can't somehow get back online.
Yeah.
So, like, to me, like, I'm already having problems with that. So I'm like, I don't do enough to invest into it. It's the same thing with, like, making these prototypes that I've been doing, these little apparatus things, is I wanted to use a laser cutter at first. And I had three different people say, well, have you looked at the Forge, whatever? And I was like, that's a $3,000 laser cutter. Like, I'm not manufacturing anything. This is just to test stuff to see if I build this, will it work? So, like, which is why I got a Cricut, because it was so much cheaper and it, like, did exactly what I needed to do, which just kind of make stuff that if it doesn't work, I don't feel bad throwing
it away. A Cricut, for anybody who doesn't know, is like a robot cutter. It's basically like a printer, but it cuts out stuff for you.
Yeah, so, like, it uses different materials. It's so incredible. It's so so specific that the second I made a 3-inch circle with a 1/4-inch circle in the inside that's center perfectly, I kind of went, oh, I couldn't do that by myself. I couldn't do that with a ruler or a compass. It just kind of plows them out really fast.
Yeah.
So, like, I keep trying to find the bare minimum to, like, stay alive, I guess, during this, rather than, like, investing it. Kind of like, because I don't do it enough. Like, you and Taylor do so much of it that it's like, yes, you have to kind of invest so much into your tech because it can't go down on this. And it's one of those things like, ugh, I have one next month.
Yeah, and I was dragging my feet for a long time, too. I mean, our buddy Taylor Hughes was, and a few guys like Cameron Zavara, a few guys I've talked to who are really doing well in the virtual show game. And I've been stage managing Justin Willman's show, so I've learned a lot. He's learned some stuff from me because I knew Zoom really well from doing my stuff, so he kind of brought me on. And then I've learned a lot from him in terms of, like, picture-picture, how to, like, efficiently interact with people and basically real time, so there's not a delay. And that's the biggest hurdle you have to get over. And so I recently just put some money into that, which, you know, guys have had for a couple months, but for me it was exactly what you're saying, dragging my feet, because, you know, it's tricky because we were talking about this the other day. The second you buy something, you know, it goes up, the money's gone, and it's like, am I making a profit? And I'm always very, like, kind of profit motivated, and that's not the best way to look at this. You know, you kind of have to look at the long term, especially now with stuff going, oh, it's going to be virtual for a bit now. This isn't temporary.
I'm kind of like that with everything. Like, even, like, video game systems, I, like, debate, like, am I going to play this? Like, is this worth $60? Am I going to sit down even for an hour just to play this? And if I don't, if I, like, really think, like, well, I've got a couple things that I haven't played yet, then I'm not going to buy it. So I kind of apply that to other things rather than just, like, performing. So, like, I totally understand this, like, I don't want to spend that much money if I'm definitely not going to use it or it's not going to help. And because I don't have, like, the end game or, like, the future, I can't see shows coming up that I'm, like, afraid to put that money in to never have to use it. It's the same. I just bought lights, LED lights, 2-panel lights, and I've used them twice, I think. I didn't even use them for the Bento Box show because it was in the middle of the afternoon and the daylight looked better than adding light to it.
That's the thing I'm finding too. Half the time you have these expensive lights and you're like, oh, my window's doing. There's a reason they shoot stuff in the day or outside because it looks way better.
It does. And the hardest part is the cards blowing out.
Sure,
when the lights, that's been the hardest thing. It's like trying to balance that it doesn't seem dim, but bright enough still that there's not, that my white cards aren't, being too overexposed. So, like, I've
all these
only
weird things you have to adjust to in virtual shows that you don't even think about it.
No,
just so, like, I've stuff been not focusing and blowing out.
Yeah, I've been trying not to use cards solely to stop that from happening. That's not my answer is not finding better equipment. It's just getting rid of the cards that are keep getting blown out.
Yeah, totally.
Which is good, but also it's kind of like I should be able to just do that kind of material.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we're all just kind of finding out like what our limits are. And I mean, I think I was on Piff's podcast last month and I was just like done with virtual shows. You listen to that interview and I'm like, I'm not doing any more virtual shows. I'm finished. I'll do something else.
I'm out of here. No more.
I'm out of here. By the way, you didn't mix up green. And then my agent, like, then a bunch of like Christmas events come through and a couple of them booked. And I'm like, well, I guess I got to do this because A, it's money. B, it's the correct way to kind of pivot because, you know, I think a lot of people were holding off, you know, especially through October of like, well, maybe we'll be able to do some small in-person company parties and whatnot. And if you're an entertainer, you know, December is like your mega month. It's the month where you make all your the most money for most, you know, entertainers.
Yeah,
unless
so
you're like
many,
a cruise ship guy or something.
Correct. But. There's so many company parties happening. Everybody wants to do something different. It's kind of like the easiest time to get a private gig or some type of corporate gig.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot of people crying. I had talked to one friend, and he's like, "Well, this I'm on track to be my worst December ever." And I was thinking I was going to be that too. And then just a handful of virtuals started booking. And so if you're a corporate entertainer or, you know, do that sort of thing, I would just, you know, be patient. It seems like people are booking that last minute. And
yeah,
honestly, there's more opportunities now than there ever have been if you want to, like, put a positive spin on it.
Yeah, it's also like I think companies are still finding out that you can do magic shows online.
Sure, yeah.
I think that's the other thing is people kind of are there. It's like somebody is in a happy hour of another company and sees they have a magician and then tell their company and then they get one. And then it's just kind of slowly making it way across all companies.
A friend was reading an article in like Newsweek or some business journal and, you know, ways to spice up your Zoom meetings. Hire a magician. And I was so surprised. Like you wouldn't normally hear about that in a business journal of like entertainment suggestions, and but it's catching on, and I think it's definitely something, you know, guys like Taylor Armstrong and other dudes around the country who really have kind of pioneered it.
Oh yeah, but it's also interesting because you couldn't hire like a juggler.
Jeff Civilico and I know a few guys that are kind of doing it, but they're more hosting and emceeing.
Yeah,
than
that
anything.
Would make sense to me. But
yeah, but juggling, that's the thing. That's the advantage. The one weird advantage we have of doing this is like it can be still interactive.
Correct. Yeah. Which
and it's funny to me when companies are like, well, how does it work? And there's literally a video of me doing a trick, talking to someone, making a selection, and then, you know, prediction happens. But still, it's exactly what you said. People have to like be in it and then, oh, this works.
They have to see it works. Yeah. The last, even for Bento Box, and I have another one coming up next week. Surprisingly, with Nathan Fan, which is going to be hilarious. But
that's
they
right.
want to us to have a meeting like next week sometimes to talk about how it's going to work.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. Most of these corporates have those. And at first, I was a little annoyed. But really, I've learned it's just comforting. I've been in many with Justin now of just you're just comforting the client going, no, it's okay. We got this. This is we have this nice, basically tiny television studio. And we've been doing a lot of these. It's okay.
Yeah.
I did one like last week and the lady was surprised that I'm like, oh, yeah, I've been doing these since March, you know, kind of off and on. So it's normal for me now. And she's like, whoa, wow, because people are just now finding out about this.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I learned from the Bento Box one. It was really just them kind of going like, it's this long and you're going to interact with people? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's really no different than any other sort of private event doing this, which is so funny. It's like all these like life skills from doing this so many years of like comforting the client of just like, oh, I need to make sure the audience is close, you know, obviously in a real world situation.
Yeah.
And right before COVID situation, oh, we need to make sure the sound's good or the lighting's good. Just things you think would be obvious, but to event planners is, you know, it's a whole nother world. And this is not what they do for a living. They do spreadsheets. Or I don't
You've
know.
You heard
what
it here first.
Do.
If you love spreadsheets, you should be a planner.
You should. You should. That's
it's
exactly
all
how it goes.
Spreadsheets.
Just all 9-to-5
spreadsheets.
You don't even get a break because most people love it so much.
Oh, they love it. They take their lunch on spreadsheets.
Carol, you want Taco Bell? No, I'm spreadsheeting. I'm enjoying it.
And then when they're at home, they take when they make their bed, they take forever because they're spreading the sheets.
Oh, I see what you did there. I see what you did.
Spread.
The comedy continues without Simon Cornell here on Two Magicians, One Mic.
One of us needs to have an accent.
Well, you're Mexican, right? So you're kind.
Do you want me to do like? Do you want to do like the? You want me to do like the real thick one? I don't know if I can do. Here's what I'd say. I don't know if I could do. I don't know if I could do like a real life one, like if you were talking to somebody, you're like, oh, they have like a Mexican accent.
Yeah, because everybody I've met doing cruise ships in Mexico is very friendly, and it's kind of a subtle, you know. It's
yeah,
like, oh,
I don't think
English
can,
is not their first language.
Correct. I don't know if I can do. I don't know how to do a subtle.
Because you're just going to become immediately, you know, stereotypical
correct.
Racist.
Well, when I was learning Spanish, because I didn't learn from my family, I had a friend who said to learn to imitate as much as you can somebody, like almost make fun of somebody speaking it, and you will sound more authentic because of it.
That's how it is. I took Japanese for a bunch of years in high school, and that's exactly how I've learned that later on, is you're mimicking not the language, the words, but like how they're saying the words.
Yeah, it's almost like you're making fun of them, but it really actually helps you sound more like you have a native tongue.
And the funny native speakers understand you better, which
correct.
Is so funny.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You're like, oh, I hope I don't offend them. Oh, arigato gozaimashita, yes. It's like me saying that sounds incredibly racist, but you're really just, once again, mimicking the sound, the cadences that are prevalent in that language.
Correct, because it doesn't sound like, it also won't sound like you like learning another language. It sounds like you already speak that language. You sound more fluent.
Yeah,
when you kind of do that. It doesn't sound like Nick Paul speaking Japanese or trying to speak Japanese. It just sounds like Japanese is coming out of Nick Paul's mouth.
Yeah, yeah. And I learned that with, you know, my Japanese teacher, who was, you know, a white guy like I am. And the second he would transition into Japanese, you're like, holy crap, how's he doing that?
Yeah.
You I should think get it's more just a confidence thing.
Yeah, what? You need to get more into that Japanese.
I took, well, including college, I took 2 semesters in college and 4 years in high school. Still can't speak any of it, which is so sad.
Yeah, you should.
Which is proof, and I say this over and over, which is because the part of the brain that learns language shuts down at 7. So it's like, why are we learning language in our 20s and 30s? It's the stupidest thing ever.
It's super hard. I like, to me, the first thing that goes away is nouns or like just definitions.
Yeah.
Like the structure is still there. I can structure a sentence fine, but it's just like forgetting what wall is. What is wall? I don't know.
Yeah. I can still read the alphabets, and I'll say them out loud, and Kristen will go, what does that mean? And I go, I have no idea. But I just read it exactly how it sounds.
Yeah, that's what's great. English is the hardest thing to do that with. You can do it with any other language. I could read Spanish easily.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't tell you what I was saying.
Sure. Yeah. That's a weird thing.
That's because English is horrible.
It is we are very lucky that it's our native tongue, because I've heard from other people that it's notoriously confusing.
Yeah.
We have so many different ways of
we have the most
things
amount
are spelled
of
and,
irregular verbs, I believe.
Yeah.
Just
yeah, we're you hear it's fun, you know, after studying language, hearing people who are not native speakers, you know, who haven't been here their whole lives or English is new to them, hearing the mistakes they make, you're like, why would you say it that way? And then you go back grammatically, you're like, oh, yeah, the way they said that makes complete sense.
Correct. I learned that. So after I learned Spanish, I started realizing why Hispanics would say Sprite. Anything that starts with an S, they always say Esa, S
sure.
whatever. And it's because the letter S in Spanish is pronounced S with
yeah,
that E
yeah.
sound right before it. So I was like, oh, so they're not saying Sprite, they're saying Sprite. I go, why are they doing that? And then when you look at it grammatically, or like from the structure of you, oh, that's because they see the letter S and they are saying it, but they're saying it the way they know it's pronounced.
I have a few Spanish friends, one of which we met at House of Magic. You can add that to your Two Magicians, One Mic bingo. comes up every episode. But 2 Spanish speakers there. And when they would text, instead of LOL or ha, 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 it would be ja, ja, ja.
Yes.
And it. Obviously, that's normal for anybody who speaks Spanish, but for me, a white guy, it took a lot for me to process that. I remember seeing that for the first time. And go, what the hell are they? What are
yeah,
because
if they put H-A-H-A, they're saying ah-ah.
And then they're mocking you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if they're screaming, if they put H, if they put A-H-H-H-H-H-H-H, they're just saying ah. Ah. Because the H's are silent.
Ah, I see.
You see that joke? I had to explain it a little bit for people who don't understand.
Comedy's always funnier when you have to explain it.
Always funnier. Always. That's why I watch The Office with the commentary on.
I will say our favorite thing to do with you and I is you'll just text me something from The Office or you'll say something from The Office and I'll have to guess if I know because we both have seen it so many times.
It's true.
And I think that's a sign of familiar comedic chops or things you're interested in.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's also understanding. It's kind of like why I like to watch a lot of random magic on YouTube, even though I have to cringe to watch it, because there's so much valuable things you can learn from watching anything. You can take anything, something that you don't think is funny or you think is bad, you have to understand why do you think that is bad. Or if there's something that is good, you have to understand why do you think that is good to get a like better understanding of kind of anything. So like The Office to me is such a sophisticated it's a blend of like really stupid humor and really sophisticated humor combined into one, which just makes it such great writing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a brilliant show. And even going back in, I've seen every episode 1,000 times, it's fun to kind of, now you can kind of deconstruct it in the same way you know, you're watching a magician and you're deconstructing where the show, where the act comes from, where the tiny routine comes from.
And it's, yeah,
I think that's kind of invaluable. And that's not something enough people do, I think, especially, I mean, you see the YouTube comics, this is how it's done, or this is it, without really not... You know, it's kind of a different type of person to just break something down.
Yeah, and you have to really understand.
How did this come together?
Yeah, and to me it's like understanding like why it's working again. Like illusions were like that for me, is that always you're just like, oh, they're just hidden somewhere. There's a girl hidden in the floor or whatever.
Yeah, but and
like,
I think that's most people's explanation.
100%. And I think the more you start looking into it, you get so mesmerized by the creative genius that it is to take to do some of that stuff, because it's not just like, oh, she fits in the box. It's like, because it's at this angle, when you're sitting at this side, there's no way you can see the depth of this person because of the 37 degree with a person sitting 80 degrees.
It's science is what it is.
It's so incredible. And I think you get such a better understanding for illusions and a better appreciation once you start like understanding like the engineering that's actually behind it and not just the method, because the method would just be, well, she's hiding.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of the bummer about, you know, hokey illusionists, I think, have ruined it, and then also shows like Masked Magician, and then people just being more interested in sleight of hand. It's just, it's taken a completely different shift.
Yeah.
If you don't do any sort of sleight of hand in the show, people walk away going, oh, that was fun, but... You know, was he that good?
And it's so weird because I believe sleight of hand has the same exact kind of understanding as illusions. It's like once you start understanding that this guy is holding a card in between just the first knuckle of his ring finger and it's pushed into the pad of his thumb and he's holding a card perfectly 90 degrees to help the sight line. Like that's such an interesting understanding of other than just like, oh, he's palming it. But it's like understanding
that. That's the more frustrating thing about mentalism. And in tonight's show, I will be doing, what, 3 or 4 mentalism things. And they will all, assuming I don't fail at them, which happens from time to time, assuming they work, will all have better reactions. And
yes,
the methods for those
are one of
less
five.
Time. 1 of 5 have taken less time, less effort on my part, not time spent, you know, with the muscle memory and getting or building the prop. It really just comes down to 1 of 5 methods. But when you're going a sleight of hand, people just immediately dismiss it as, oh, well, they were behind his hand. The cards were behind his hand somehow.
Yeah, and it's almost interesting. You kind of think, well, does that mean the methods are better in mentalism? Like, could you start using more methods, like sleight of hand tricks using mentalism methods?
Well, this is like...
This is getting
deep. I mean, this is why I'm interested in psychology, and I'm about to start my master's in it in January, and I'm friggin' terrified. But I think there is something for me to gain in studying it, and exactly what you were talking about. Okay, these are psychological methods that mentalists are using people's memories against them, you know, yada, yada. But there's got to be ways to do that with sleight of hand. I mean, there are, you know, an illusion. It's like, okay, here's the base. It's empty. Great. And then it's either loaded when they're not paying attention or it's switched.
Yeah.
But there's got to be other ways around that to where, like, no, I was just thinking of the color green.
Yeah.
You know, I was only thinking of green. There's no way he could have known that because it's so simple that people immediately block out every other possible explanation because of how easy it was to get to the surprise.
It's very interesting because, like, what I've been doing at home here is making these kind of little apparatus, mini illusions, if you will, and applying other methods to them to kind of help strengthen them. So it's like I made a Steinmeier illusion that Lance Burton used to do all the time to, like, apparatus style. It's really small. But because the larger piece, you can't show empty, right? Because it's a 6-foot piece of wood or whatever. Because it's smaller, I can pick things up and show them fairly before setting up the actual illusion. So it kind of, because I made it smaller, there's almost some sleights involved now into a genuine illusion that are helping it. And it's kind of been fun doing that, but it's also a little frustrating because sometimes it's like, oh, if only I could do this. And then it's like, I don't have an engineering background. So it's like, well, I don't know how to make that mechanism. So I have to make something else.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I'm always fascinated when I've worked with, like, Blake Voigt. He literally studied how to build, you know, basically what you're doing, building small models and small makeups. And I forget exactly what his degree was, but it wasn't, maybe it was engineering. He was on the podcast a couple of years ago, but he talks about that a lot. And, you know, just to have a brain like that is amazing. But there is something to, and I think you did, it was either this one or another one, you did it at the show we did in September, you know, a tiny version of the metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm. I did that I did that at the show with you, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, it starts off, you could hear the audience going, oh, well, look at this toy. And then you do the trick, and they're like, oh, in some ways it's more amazing because, like, I'm watching on a camera, you know, in a big screen. There's no way you could have done any sleight of hand.
Yeah.
In a real metamorphosis, it's like, well, giant curtain.
Yeah, you know, and that's what's been so fun about them, and, like, it's just so weird. So that's, like, it's very interesting to talk about, like, how mentalism methods are being used and are almost more, you know, audiences dismiss on how it could be done, but it's almost like such a simple method. Like, mentalism methods are always so easy because it's like I just glued another piece of paper in the envelope, and when I cut one side, I get a different out. And not saying that that's a dumb method, because I've been actually playing with a bunch of double-sided envelope stuff.
No, yeah, I've added confabulation into my show, which is, you know, if you're not a magician, is a big reveal of a bunch of things that happen, and drag my feet for the longest time, and then put it in and go, oh, people lose their shit over this.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't make any sense to them. And so, like, trying to figure out how to, like, apply that to other tricks is very interesting because I don't even have an example of how one would do that, because I have an apparatus trick that I put in sleight of hand with, and it's made the apparatus smaller because I did that. I was able to actually design it smaller than it needs to be. So it's like, how can I combine other methods from other categories of magic to make the one thing I'm doing stronger?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's something everybody can kind of work on, because you see in, like, South Korea and the other parts of the world where they're doing this amazing magic with stuff they build, and it's just mind-boggling. Like, I feel like they're maybe on ahead of it in terms of using their people's thought process and psychology against them with visual things as opposed to predictions.
I had a conversation with Eric Chen once, and he was saying, you know, Americans are always behind in magic, and it's because everywhere around the world they have tighter circles of people, of, like, hive minds. And it's very interesting on how, we kind of, Americans, you know, if we have a great trick, it's like, I got it, but I like, don't want to tell anybody else.
Yeah.
I'm just going
to... It wasn't until I got to L.A. that, and I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast before, that... I guess Orlando was like this too, a little bit of a small magic community. And Detroit, where I'm from too, it seems like it's there. It's forming more and more. I mean, obviously there's, like, Colon and stuff. But when I was growing up, it wasn't as tight-knit as it is now. But yeah, L.A. really is just the place. And I think that's the thing I miss the most about not being able to go to the castle now. Of not just, hey, that's how I network and book gigs. And I'm sure you do too.
Yeah.
But also just like, oh, hey, so-and-so, what do you think of this? Or what do you think of this idea?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when there was a couple times we were there where like three people that I knew were just sitting in the library with me, just sitting there. We weren't going to see shows, we weren't doing anything. And I just said, let's play a game. And the game is you get a book for somebody else. And then everyone has 5 minutes to learn one trick in that book.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And so it's
like
sounds...
you can't, how else would you do that? Like, that's not something you could, we have this amazing magic library at the Magic Castle of just books that are, you know, 100-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can't do that unless you literally have that at your house.
Correct. And, but then people have to come over and then it's just kind of even more, and you couldn't be like, oh, give me the library of your, like, show me your library and then I'll pick a book for you. Like,
yeah.
The best part of the castle of doing that game was, like, I'm going to pick a book that I know you don't have. Because why would you buy this Carl Fuves self-working paper magic book? By the way, I bought that book yesterday. So,
did you? Oh, nice. I may have to borrow it. You should force me to learn something, excuse me, from it, because I'm really – I haven't learned anything new.
Okay, so Nathan Fan and I years ago both read one book. You had to do every trick in the book. You even if it taught you how to double lift or whatever it taught you how to do, you had to do it exactly the way it taught you. You had to get through the whole book, not by reading it, but physically doing it.
That's sometimes harder because then you have to relearn.
Correct. I think he didn't make it through, but I did all of Royal Road to Card Magic.
Oh, nice.
It was exhausting, but I learned so much and saw so much material that was so good, and I could not believe people were not doing it.
Yeah, I have that on my shelf. I don't have a huge magic library. A lot of it's digital, and I'm pretty ashamed that I don't have more. But, you know, I have that, and I'll occasionally just kind of open it up and go, oh, that's interesting. Would have never thought of that. And sometimes it's, you know, you go back through these old ideas and old books, and this applies to kind of any art form.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
like, I this wouldn't work at all today. And then you find a little, you're really good about that, finding a little bit of a gem in something that the routine itself is terrible. But like,
yes.
Oh, the way they switch the card or
yeah,
whatnot,
like, there's
is
like
amazing.
One principle. There's like one thing in those old tricks that you just kind of go, why, what if I did that here? So like I've been doing a couple of tricks with paper, using paper, cutting paper. And so I was at the Apple dropping off some stuff because we're doing a little lecture for them in December. And I'm doing a lot of paper stuff, which is just weird. Somebody basically, it's Tony Clark, me and Nathan Cranzo. And Nathan Cranzo said, I call dibs and card tricks. So I was like, okay, that's fine. I'll just do non-card stuff, which is fine. So
that's
like,
kind of a good thing to have, too.
Yeah.
It's a good challenge.
It's hard, too, because you have to teach it. So it's not even just like finding material that's not card material to perform, but good enough that I can teach it. So I've had, Magic Pavel. Pavel's got a lot of stuff. And there's one more book. Has some weird paper stuff. So, like, I don't think you've seen this. It's a long strip of paper that has three circles cut out into it and then three squares. So you're looking at a strip of paper, three squares, three circles, and you hold it with the circles at the top and you put it behind your back and you say, look, it's changed. When you bring it back out, the squares are now on top. And you say, I'll change it back. And you put it behind your back, you bring it out, and now the circles are on top. And you go, ha, to get it? And they go, no. And you go, watch this. And you cover the paper and you drag your hand across, and when your hand gets to the bottom, there's now a square and a circle every other hole. And it's so silly, and I made it especially with the Cricut because I was able to just cut all those shapes out and get it done. But I showed Brent at the Apple and he kind of went, that's so stupid and good at the same exact time, because it's so simple. Like, you couldn't do a 5-minute routine off of it, but it's really strong. And so then that's when I found the self-working paper magic Carl Fuves, and I went, I'm going to buy this book because there's got to be something crazy in there. There's just got to be – I have so much hope. There could be – you could give me the worst magic book, and I will still be like, oh, but I'm sure there's going to be something good in there.
Yeah, and I think that's important to do, and I think that's something a lot of people overlook, myself included. But, yeah, and the funny part is with going back to virtual shows is that – you know, nowadays you really need stuff to move quickly. You know, I'm used to in shows, I'm having to force myself slow down in live shows because I talk so fast. I'm missing the beats. You know, I'm missing the moments of revelation. But in Zoom shows, you literally got like 2 minutes of routine, it feels like sometimes.
Yeah.
If your opener is too long, you lose people.
Yeah. It's that and I like, because I can't interact with somebody, it was already going shorter. Because it's not like I can bring someone on stage and then have a conversation with them, asking them about themselves. Like, you can kind of do that, but there's this, like, moment where it's silent, and you just kind of go, like, well, I guess I'm going to continue the trick.
Yeah, and you have to it's a little bit tricky because, you know, like, the picture-in-picture stuff, which is great, you can chat with people, but if they're not a chatty person, and a lot of times with these corporates I'm finding, if it's not a ticketed event, people really don't want to interact with you. Even I've done a whole bunch with Justin, and, you know, he always kills it, and they always have a good time, but it takes a couple of routines for people to get on board with, like, oh, I guess I'm talking with the magician. It's different, like, when they bought tickets and they're excited to be there, but yeah, so that's a whole nother obstacle you have to get over sometimes.
Yeah, and that's what I see in virtual shows, especially like corporate stuff, is I always start with the little mini metamorphosis because it's so stupid and weird and silly that it makes you feel like you're going to watch something interesting because it starts with something very weird that seems like a throwaway, but then it's actually a really good trick. Like you said, people see it and they kind of go, well, I don't understand.
Yeah.
So like the hardest part about virtual shows is like, finding this new structure on a show.
Yeah. I'm going through that now. Yeah, with, like I said, nothing on the books, and now a few are booked, and I'm like, oh, I really got to make sure that, like you said, the structure is good and that it flows nicely and that there's, you know, beginning, middle, and end. And also just like, you know, I have a few videos in there, and I was kind of hesitant to even play videos, but you really need, like, those breaks. It's kind of like going from pieces of talking to music in a live show. You need audiences' brains to kind of readjust and restart over.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is a different image. This is a different thing happening, as opposed to just talking to the camera for 45 minutes. That's a very different situation.
Yeah. It's different. It's weird, but I feel like we're all slowly figuring it out. And I feel like by the time we've gone, great, I can do this all day, is everything's going to open back up. And we have to start over.
Yeah, so all of us get to that point where I can do this all day. Everybody think, get into that mindset.
Yes, if we all just believe that we could do virtual shows every day, everything will open up.
Well, this has been fun. This has been a good, you know, newish episode to bring things back. So Robert's going to, you know, hopefully be here as much as possible. We're going to try to bring some, I would love to get like some people on for interviews. Hopefully you can get us, like, you know, I'm just asking you this now, but maybe we can get Jim Steinmeier, or
that would be great.
Your buddies with him. I'll try to get like Chipper.
I like that. That sounds so good.
Who are you doing right now? You're doing the episode I just edited of Rob Zabrecki's show. We tried to contact famous Andy Kaufman, and you sound like Andy Kaufman right now.
It does
now.
Kind of sound like that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Which is essentially just the same as like a Mexican person.
He's essentially doing a very racist impression. I never thought of that until now. He's such a nice guy. You didn't see it coming.
No.
But we're going to try to get some more guests on. I'm going to reach out to a bunch of people, and, you know, hopefully people are still willing to, because that's how Simon and I got Teller on and all these, like, bigger names like Mark Evan Jackson. A, they're really nice people for taking their time, but B, it was the beginning of quarantine where you're like, I know you're not doing anything right now. I'm going, like, to email you.
Here's the reference to end off of. It's like Michael Scott asking Jim if he has any plans tonight. He says no. Then he calls to call off the work assignment. And he goes, it's dinner at my house. And he goes, I can't. He goes, oh, you said you weren't doing anything. That's how I imagined you asking Teller.
Yeah. You said you had nothing going on Tuesday. You told me they weren't refilming Fool Us until November.
Yeah. Gotcha.
I love that in the episode, too, where Jim always pays very close attention to when Michael is busy, and that's when they reach back out. Oh, Michael, what are you doing on Saturday? Oh, I got improv class, or whatever it was he's doing.
He does have improv class.
He's just so sad and angry that his dreams of getting to hang out with Jim and Pam are, you know, gone because he already has previous plans. So funny.
So good.
This is good. This is great. Well, do you want to do a sign off? He just pulled out a tiny guitar.
Thank you for being here, watching and listening.
He's actually playing right now. I just want to let you know that.
Listening to the podcast.
Oh, this is the new, maybe that's the new intro and outro music, and people are going to be even more confused. Great. Thank you, Robert Ramirez. We'll talk to you.
Thank you, Nicholas Paul.
Okay.
What's your social security number?
7. Just 7.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemic.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs at @twomagiciansonemic. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.